time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Bill Witherup. Bill Witherup is a local poet, performance artist, playwright, Hanford Downwinder, and artist in residence with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. He is the co-editor of the anthology Words from the House of the Dead, Prison Writings from Soledad, and he is the author of numerous books, including Bixby Creek and Four from Kentucky, Black Ash, Orange Fire, Collected Poems, 1959 to 1985, Men at Work, and Downwind, Downriver, New and Selected Poems. Bill, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
It's more than a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are going to start out. You are going to read us a piece from Eugene V. Debs' Reader to get things rolling.
Yeah, it's a way of warming up my voice. And it's the first paragraph from his article, The Martyred Apostles of Labor, published in the New Time in 1898. And I thought this was appropriate to our times and also a way of leading into what I'm going to read and talk about this morning. The Martyred Apostles of Labor. He's talking about the execution of the Haymarket rioters in 1886 in Chicago, in which eight anarchists were hung for having somebody threw a bomb in the crowd, and lo and behold, a policeman is killed, and whenever a policeman is killed, you know how that goes. So they executed these people without really evidence of their involvement in the situation. The century now closing is luminous with great achievements. In every department of human endeavor, marvelous progress has been made. By the magic of the machine, which sprang from the inventive genius of man, wealth has been created in fabulous abundance. But, alas, this wealth, instead of blessing the race, has been the means of enslaving it. The few have come in possession of all, and the many have been reduced to the extremity of living by permission. Close quote. And the reason I chose that was to connect, in my mind, my various projects and concerns. And one might ask, how does this connect with Hanford and making of the atomic bombs, which I'll be talking about this morning? In my mind, it was the secrecy behind the creation of the Manhattan Project that really put the national security state in high gear. And so, compressing history, my connections with Hanford, where my father worked, and my current project, the Gene Debs Labor Ensemble, and also being artist-in-residence for Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, involved with my friend Stephen Gilbert's Healthy World Theater, are all of a piece, and so that's kind of the lead-in to take it away, Mike.
So you spent a lot of your early years at Hanford because your father worked there at the Hanford Engineering Works.
Maybe. Well, actually, Hanford was the facility, the town where most of the workers lived in. Was Richland, Washington. Some of the workers lived in Pasco and some in Kennewick, which is now known as the Tri-Cities. But Richland was the community, essentially an old farm town, rebuilt to house the workers from the Manhattan Project.
And when you were growing up there, what was it like? I mean, you, for one thing, you never really knew what your dad did.
No, we came out from Kansas City in 1944, and my father, I was 9 years old, and my siblings were younger, and my father went to work at B Reactor, and I only found out this, which was the first nuclear reactor, I only found out this later in life, after he had retired, and his job was, his first job was to help in quality control, and checking in the graphite blocks that went into the B-reactor itself. And then he was worked as a timekeeper, and then later on he was trained as an operating engineer to work inside what they called the Queen Mary's, where they processed the plutonium with a mix of chemicals into separated the plutonium out into these little pucks. So, but I didn't know that when I was younger, because if your parents worked at Hanford, mother or father, they were not allowed to talk about their work. It was highly secret, very controlled. It was a secret society, but to those of us who lived in the community, it was a very normal life, except there were no black people or Hispanics, or we're all white folks. And that was kind of deliberate on the part of General Leslie Groves. It's a long story to try to compress into the morning, but...
Yeah, you had mentioned to me earlier the only time you ever saw people of color was during the baseball games.
Or the football games when we played the Pasco Bulldogs. And that was prior to the influx of Hispanic workers in Pasco. And the first black construction worker I met was in the summer of 53 when I worked at the Hanford Project as a laborer, just for the summer. But yeah, so it was essentially an all-white community, but we thought it was very normal.
So, and yet there was a sense of secrecy there. Didn't you guys used to get visited by military security people every 6 months?
Oh yeah, well military intelligence come around and talk to your neighbors about your father or mother, and of course we as children didn't know that, and so it was. I talk about that somewhat in my little personal essay called Mother Withrop's Top Secret Cherry Pie, which is in my collection Men at Work, and also in the collection Learning to Glow, a Nuclear Reader. And I talk about the secrecy. Of course, we as children we didn't know that, you know, but everybody in the community was very on alert about, you know, you didn't talk about your work, or if the higher ups found out that you were talking about your work, the moving van was at your door the next day, and you were out of there. So it was really a government town, sort of like the old coal mining government towns. You know, it was a company town from the get go, and it still is in a way.
So was there a sense of, as a child, did you have a sense of fear about any of that, or was it just
life? No, it was an idyllic life. It was sort of like Huck Finn on the Mississippi, you know, because it was a wonderful environment to grow up in, and for kids, you know, and there wasn't really a sense of class, because everybody dressed the same, you know, and although there was a class structure, and so, you know, it was the West, it was Indians, it was the Wild West Cowboys, it was just really exciting to, you know, I learned to swim in the Columbia River, you know. So it was a kind of idyllic life, and we used to, sad to say, we used to rifle the Indian burial grounds along the river. We didn't know any better, looking for beads and arrowheads and so on and so forth. So it was a really historical, an exciting place to grow up. Still, I love the environment over there, as radioactive as it is. I mean, the river, before it became all dammed up and into a lake, was just a wonderful place to be a young man and young woman, I guess.
And so it wasn't until later, as you became an adult, that you started putting two and two together?
Oh, yes, because it was a very close society. You never heard from pulpit or school any criticism of the Hanford Project. So only later in life, as I became more politically aware, you know, and began to write and think more about nuclear war and so on and so forth, did I become aware of the incredible history of Hanford. I guess I might jump to a poem that kind of expresses I guess first I'll start with working two poems about my father's work at Hanford. He later, after he retired, he got prostate cancer, which eventually became bone cancer, and so I'll work in these two poems. This is from the collection Downwind, Downriver. My father dying, 1984. He hums with prostate cancer, carried plutonium home in his underwear. Ashes of Trinity, ashes of Nagasaki. For Christ's sake, Dad, you went to work daily out of love and duty. But did the devil's job. You guys stoked Tell's ovens, brought home shadows in your lunchboxes. All the discarded radiation badges did not monitor how much your children love you or measure 30 years of labor smoldering in your work pants or count the sperm spitting across centuries, igniting everywhere karmic fires. My father, of course, was patriotic until his day of his death. And he, you know, believed in the mission of Hanford, as many who still live there do. They all believe that their involvement with creating, especially the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, which was plutonium fueled, they believed in the mythology that it helped to end the Second World War, and also that it helped fend off the Russians during the Cold War. So he was patriotic until the day of his death. And when I heard my father was dying, I was working in Petaluma as a warehouseman in a pesticide company that delivered fertilizers and pesticides, I'm sorry to say. And so my mother said, come home if you want to see your father. And so we had hospice. So I drove all the way in my Volkswagen without brakes from Petaluma, California, to spend some time with my father. And this is the poem about his death. It ends with an image about trains. And this goes back to in Kansas City. My father used to take me down to the roundhouse to see the trains turn around. And also we came out on the train, so trains have a connection to the poem and to the image here. Mervyn Clyde Witherup, born July 14, 1910, died May 12, 1988. Nearing the end, father was all bones and pain. The tumor had eaten him down to the rind. Yet little he complained or whined. Sulfate of morphine eased him somewhat, and he kept his mind and wit, though talking was difficult. A dry wind off the volcanic desert went through each of his rooms, snuffing out cells, left an alkaloid crust on his tongue. We stood by with sponge on a stick when he was assaulted by thirst and images. Give me your hand, he said, and lead me to the water cooler. I've been up in the sky. I'm very tired. Then, irritated with us, he would ask to be left alone. He would suck a sponge and grab the lifting bar, be off again, brachiating from cloud to cloud. Is there a station nearby? How do we get out of here? You'll have to help me, son. He died on graveyard shift. The train came for him at 3 a.m., when he ran to catch it, he was out of breath. My father, as did many of the workers, and most of them were young when they came to work at Hanford, either they had did not serve in World War II due to some physical problem, or they came there after World War II, and they were all young people. And my father's did, most of the other workers worked shift work all his life, which as you know, has a wear and tear on your physiology. You know, 5 days of swings, 5 days of days, and then they had to, they call long change, and then 5 days of graveyard. So, you know, that takes your, takes toll on your body.
So he was in the, involved with the conversion of the yellow cake to the plutonium pucks.
Yeah, that's what they, in the, these huge canyons, which they, after they took the, irradiated, rods over to the, and then they would, add some, there were toxic chemicals, very corrosive chemicals, and it was a very, one of the most toxic places to live was actually more toxic than working in the reactor itself, because you're also working around all these corrosive chemicals as well as, plutonium slurry. And so, although they worked behind windows, you know, with these automatic, arms and so forth and hands, and they wore these paper suits and booties, you know, stuff gets into your system, you know, as it does into the prostate in my father's case. So, yeah, it's a highly toxic place, and it still is. Yeah.
So much of that now resides in those, I mean, a lot resides in the tanks, the, what is it, 140-something multi-million gallon tanks that are leaking into the Columbia River.
Yeah. There's a new book out called Atomic Wastelands, isn't that it, Stephen? Which talks about the difficulty of the cleanup. It's a really complicated process, and so a lot of that's filtering into the water table, into Columbia River, and into all the things that grow and feed on, you know, on plants and so on. So it's still there in the environment, and.
And B reactor, which your father worked at, they're currently looking at turning into, I believe they've made a decision to turn it into a museum, a historical site.
Right, a national monument. It's sort of like making Dachau a national monument. Well, I guess you can visit Dachau or Belsen. And I guess it's been about, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 years ago that I visited Hanford with WPSR and some scientists from and educators from Chelyabinsk, Russia, and as we went toward the situation, I just was very overwhelming to me, because it was just a lot of death out there. You just sense the death that, you know, of humans and animals. It's really a graveyard. So I'll segue to a recent poem, which is in my current manuscript, The Poet is Hornet. B Reactor, Hanford, a National Monument. Wind gusting down the Columbia and scouring the scablands is filled with the moaning voices of Nagasaki dead. A mutant dragonfly sips a chemical cocktail from a dank cooling pond. Coyote has a tumor on his tongue, and magpie is blind, see her hopping in circles, dragging her wings and once saucy tail. Grave, mausoleum, sarcophagus, I search for a new word to name my loathing and disgust for what will now amuse gaping tourists.
As well as the B reactor there being turned into a monument, locally here at the University of Washington, they're looking at converting the former reactor that was on campus there to, I believe, a positive history, a positive in, maybe I'm not saying that right, a history of what actually went down from let's say, the downwinders, and as opposed to the company town view of what went down at Hanford.
Yeah, this is a project conceived by my friend Stephen Gilbert, who's also currently president of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, and his idea is to have it be try to have a national peace museum, I guess you could say, which really tells the true story of what went on at Hanford, including comments from workers who are still living and so on and so forth. So it's a big project to think about. But there is a Hanford Science Museum over there, but it's very narrow in concept, and it's so pro Hanford and the mythology of having developed the atomic bomb that it's really one-sided.
So you have also, in your poetry, have written about a lot of things, as well as the current war that is raging in Iraq. And I'm wondering if you can do a short reading on that.
Yeah, as I was talking with you about the other day, breakfast, most poets start out writing love poems, you know, unrequited love. You have a crush on somebody. And so you start out as romantic. And then later on, as I got older, I kind of reversed the usual character development as I got more radical as I got older rather than more conservative. So I'll just read a little a poem about my attitude toward the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Rice is the title of it. Again, this is from the my manuscript in progress, The Poet as Hornet, and this is taken from an idea of the Zarathustrians. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice. At death, the four murderers will not go to the House of Songs. Oil and blood on their sleeves, vomit over their expensive shoes. The four liars will stagger toward the realm of darkness and separation, where they must listen for 10,000 lifetimes to the screams of Iraqi children. That's sort of one of my poems in screeds against the Iraq War and against the murderers who caused it. And glad they're on their way out. I hope with the election of Obama that we'll have a more peaceful world.
So, in addition to your poetry, you are also a playwright, and you are working, you have many irons in the fire.
I have too many irons in the fire. Yeah, I got, my computer just crashed. So, I've written several plays, and also my friend Stephen Gilbert has commissioned a play on pesticide drift from his book on toxicology. So I've been working on a play about pesticide drift in the Yakima Valley among agricultural workers, and the title of it is La Cucaracha, and it's become a really sprawling Elizabethan block-long mural play, which I'm trying to tidy up.
And I want to mention briefly your Eugene Debs Labor Ensemble, because I see that as very inspiring and not getting the attention it deserves.
Yeah, well, in short, three or four years ago, I became interested in the history of Eugene V. Debs, and the more I read about him, the more I got inspired by him, and I started working on a play about Debs, which is another sprawling, unfinished play I have in the works. And then a couple of years ago, I decided, since it's hard to get plays produced, I'll form my own theater group, and so I formed the Gene Debs Labor Ensemble, which is a for-profit small business with no capital. And my hope and ambition is to build a Eugene V. Debs labor center in Seattle, Washington. It's an ambition and hope that may never be realized, but it keeps me off the streets and out of trouble.
All right, and I know you have a website in addition to your books, although it has a somewhat long web name.
That's www.debslaborensemble.org. It's
okay,
debslaborensemble.org. It's all one in jammed word, and it's called Bringing Theater to the Working Class. So I'm looking for George Soros or somebody to fund my project.
We have just a few minutes left. I'm wondering if we have time for you to read us one more poem.
Okay, well, let's see. I don't know. What do I read then? I'll just... here's John Wayne, Gunslinger, Rest in Peace, from Downwind, Downriver. It talks about having grown up along the Columbia River on White Bluffs. And John Wayne having been, you know, the mythological Western conservative. John Wayne, Gunslinger, rest in peace. John Wayne, Gunslinger, pranced out from the white city on the hill. At White Bluffs, way out west, partner, Alpha, Beta, and Gamma charged back and forth, whooping it up, having a great time. Cayuses hoofing chalky dust. The Braves mooned John, pissed off the clip, waggled their dicks at him. We have your wives. We have your sons. What are you going to do, Whitey? Wayne was cool, unflinching, a face one wears before big evil. The moment his gelding's forelegs splashed into the icy, fast-flowing river, a pitchy tumor arrow thunked smack into the wet brain of our hero, gunslinger, John Wayne. John Wayne died of cancer from having been around nuclear tests during one of his filmings. It was okay to say those two words on air.
I think we can get away with that one.
Okay.
If not, I'll be hearing about that. Talking with Bill Witherup, he's a local poet, performance artist, playwright, Hanford Downwinder, and artist in residence with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. And Bill, again, what was your website for the Debs, was it debslaborensemble.org?
Yeah, it's www.debslaborensemble.org. It's all one word. Bringing theater to the working class.
Very good. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I wanted to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and along with my friend Stephen Gilbert.
Thanks for coming in, Steve.